I'm glad David has been here for the last 2 days to listen to the conversation and meet many of you and participate in conversations and worship and our breakouts, because this is his first time that he has been to the EP. So now he knows you a little better as he comes up to lead our final plenary, which is not a good plenary. David, for those of you who haven't met him, pastor of Keller Park Church in South Bend, and he's the managing editor of the Institute for Mennonite Studies at AMBS up in Elkhart, Indiana. But he is also the co-author of the recent book, A Field Guide to Christian Nonviolence, Key Thinkers, Activists, and Movements for the Gospel of Peace, that was published last year with Miles Wernz. And so his name was one of the first names on the list when we began to think about who could we have come speak to us about peace building. David is also here with, you have probably met, I hope, his family, Andrea and Lisa and Wesley. So thank you all for coming with him and being on this adventure with him. So with that, David Kramer.
I was 3 weeks into my first year at a small evangelical college in northern Indiana when my dorm mate ducked into the public showers to announce that a plane had crashed into the World Trade Center tower in New York City. As a right-wing political junkie at the time, I turned to my RA, who was also in the shower, and quipped, "I got 10 bucks, it was Osama bin Laden." I eventually headed to class, where a TV was rolled into the room so we could watch footage of the crash, and then the second one that confirmed that it was indeed a terrorist attack. In the months that followed, I was an apologist for the war in Afghanistan, though most of my classmates didn't take much convincing. My sophomore year, I wrote a term paper for my ethics class titled A Critique of Pacifism, which I submitted to my pacifist ethics professor. He gave it back with a lot of red ink and a recommendation that I read John Howard Yoder's The Politics of Jesus so I would know what the hell I was talking about. I picked up a copy at the local family Christian bookstore, but couldn't get through the first chapter with all that discussion of ethical theory, so I put it down for a few years. I picked it back up while studying at an evangelical seminary in the mid-2000s. The United States was now engaged in not one, but two active wars abroad. I had a little bit more ethical theory under my belt, and Yoder started making a lot more sense to me. So much so that I moved on from The Politics of Jesus to just about any Yoder book I could get my hands on. For Christmas, and I think it was 2008, Andrea bought me about half a dozen of those little Yoder tracts by Herald Press, and I considered the most thoughtful Christmas gift I had ever received. Then I started reading not just Yoder, but everyone who wrote on Yoder. I read essays by Michael Cartwright and John Nugent, among many others. My first published article was a review of three collections of essays on Yoder's work, which I titled Inheriting Yoder Faithfully. On August 11, 2010, I wrote Stanley Hauerwas a letter telling him that my dad had died earlier that day and that I'd just finished reading his memoir, Hannah's Child, which was helping me through the loss. That fall, I met Glenn Stassen at a conference and asked where I should go to study Yoder's work. He suggested Baylor to study with Paul Martins and Jonathan Tran, so I applied there on his recommendation and was accepted the following spring after applying and getting rejected by Therese at Marquette, but it all worked out okay. She invited me to this, so. Yeah. At Baylor, I managed to get through most of my courses with topics, with paper topics like Yoder and Aquinas on war, or Yoder and Bard on natural theology, or Yoder and Paul on union with Christ. You know the drill. I even got to TA for one of Stassen's proteges, Reggie Williams. Then I wrote my dissertation on the relationships among the social ethics of Walter Rauschenbusch, Reinhold Niebuhr, and Yoder, where I essentially argued that Yoder's work is more indebted to the former two than Hauerwas likes to admit. And of course, Jonathan Tran was one of my readers, so he was able to arrange for Hauerwas to come and sit on my committee. And suffice it to say that he wasn't convinced by my reading, but he had some gracious things to say and didn't stop me from passing. At some point during these years, I became what you might call an Ecclesia Project lurker. I was intrigued by the work you do. I read some of your pamphlets and books, and some of my professors and mentors are full-fledged EP endorsers. But until this weekend, for reasons I won't begin to attempt to justify, I have not personally participated in an EP gathering or event. Now, being an EP lurker means a couple things. First, it means I received this invitation to speak with great fear and trembling. I was, after all, discipled into the way of Christian nonviolence by EP theologians and ethicists. The list of initial endorsers from that May 2002 Hauerwas and Buddy Subversive Friendship pamphlet reads like a bibliography of my reading list from about 2010. What could I possibly say about nonviolence to you all who taught me to be nonviolent? But second, being an EP lurker means that I form some impressions of EP's views of nonviolence that may or may not be entirely accurate, or at least maybe not entirely up to date. So knowing that EP was started by Hauerwas and his colleagues and friends and students has led me to believe that EP's general approach to nonviolence is what we used to call Yoderian, or what Yoder himself called the passivism of the messianic community, or what Hauerwas might call ecclesial nonviolence, or what Hauerwas' detractors would call ecclesiocentric nonviolence, or what advocates of just war who comment casually on passivism simply call the Yoder-Hauerwas view. This is the view that there's a specific Christological form of passivism that's embodied in the church, and that by contrast, identifies the violence of the world for what it is. There are hints of this kind of nonviolence in the subtitle to our gathering, Practicing the Peace the World Cannot Give. So I was reminded this weekend that that's a quote from Jesus, so you're in good company. This is the kind of nonviolence that John Nugent calls Shalom A, as Phil discussed in our opening session. And it's the kind of nonviolence that was deeply formative for me. It provided an off-ramp for me from the right-wing militaristic evangelicalism of my upbringing. I believe there's much to be said for this kind of nonviolence. But I've also come to the conviction that ecclesial nonviolence is incomplete at best and perhaps a bit problematic at worst. Two major events have led me to this conclusion. The first happened in the middle of my time at Baylor. Ever since becoming a self-proclaimed Yoderian, I had heard vague allusions to Yoder's idiosyncratic views on sexuality within the church. As with many white male Yoder scholars in the early 2000s, I had brushed this aside as either a strange personality quirk or some kind of theological exploration that was unrelated to his passivism. Then in 2013, a number of women, mostly from the Mennonite Church, publicly and forcefully named Yoder's actions for what they were, a form of violence. The fact that arguably the most influential voice for Christian pacifism in the 20th century, and certainly the most influential theologian in my life, was himself a perpetrator of sexualized violence was disorienting for me, to say the least. The second event that complicated my views of ecclesial nonviolence was that on January 1st, 2017, with my newly minted PhD in hand, I began pastoring a small evangelical congregation in a low-income neighborhood in South Bend, Indiana. 19 days later, Donald Trump was inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States. I learned through the crucible of leading a congregation through the tumultuous 4 years of Trump's presidency, the last of which included a pandemic, that declaring the church as the alternative to the violence of the world requires a number of caveats. Theological aphorisms I had absorbed, like, let the church be the church so the world can be the world, started to ring a little hollow when the world was killing my neighbors with the vocal support of the church writ large. The denomination that we were a part of at the time started careening headlong into Christian nationalism. Although I had long been convinced to stay true of the church of my baptism, as a pastor, I became even more convinced that faithfulness to the gospel required realigning our denominational ties. This ultimately landed us in the Mennonite Church, a place from which our former denomination had splintered about 150 years ago, so we viewed it as a homecoming, long overdue. Our local church's mission statement is to seek the peace or shalom of our neighborhood by sharing God's love with our neighbors. Our vision is to become a church that follows Jesus, the Prince of Peace, and embodies God's peaceful kingdom in our neighborhood, the city of South Bend, and beyond. I learned that embodying this mission and vision requires more than a rejection of war. It requires speaking up and acting on behalf of those in our community who are being deprived of shalom, whether due to socioeconomic status, citizenship status, racial or ethnic identity, gender, sexuality, disability, or some combination thereof. Through this all, I sought to stay true to my pacifist convictions. In addition to pastoring, I began working at Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary, that's AMBS, where I regularly teach the course Christian Attitudes Toward War, Peace, and Revolution. This course originally had been designed and was then taught for decades by Yoder at AMBS. And due to his troubling legacy at the seminary, I set out to redesign the course in such a way that none of Yoder's writings would be required reading. While this was not without its challenges, as Yoder had literally written the book, Christian Attitudes Toward War, Peace, and Revolution, Brazos Press, I found it refreshing and inspiring to rework the course. I realized that my laser-sharp focus on Yoderian nonviolence, through that laser-sharp focus, I had missed out on a great cloud of witnesses to Christian nonviolence in the 20th and 21st centuries. These witnesses spoke in different registers and from different contexts from what I was used to. They differed in their understandings of what constitutes violence and how best to respond to it. They differed in their biblical and theological underpinnings for their understandings of nonviolence, but they all shared a desire to faithfully live out the gospel of peace in their respective contexts. And so with my Baylor colleague, Miles Wernz, we wrote a field guide to Christian nonviolence to make sense of this diversity of Christian witnesses to nonviolence. As we state in the introduction, our argument is that Christian nonviolence at its best does not promise to end all wars or permanently settle all disputes. Rather, Christian nonviolence is an exercise of Christian wisdom guided by the Spirit who transforms our minds so that we may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. The question for us to discern as we conclude this EP gathering then is this: how is the Spirit guiding us to embody the gospel of peace in our context today? I understand the concern that EP seems to have shifted over the years in its articulation and expression of nonviolence and shalom. But I would like to suggest that this is at least in part because our context has shifted. As a number of longtime EP participants have reflected, EP's expression of nonviolence in the early years was in large part a response to 9/11, that is, to American empire and US wars abroad. It's fairly easy to remain nonpartisan when Republicans and Democrats alike dismiss you as a pacifist voice crying out in the wilderness. But in subsequent years, American empire has come home to roost in the form of white Christian nationalism, which found its biggest promoter in a sexually violent reality TV personality who rode his way to the White House on 81% of the evangelical Christian vote. According to Indianapolis-based sociologist Andrew Whitehead in his new book, American Idolatry, close to two-thirds of white American Christians are at least favorable toward Christian nationalism, and that number increases to over 75% if we look solely at white evangelicals. This is a problem not only for the United States, but also, perhaps especially, for the church. January 6, 2021 has become the new 9/11 for our current generation. Trying to embody nonviolence in this new reality might not make you a Democrat, but it should at least make you not a Republican. And while we may lament a two-party system that provides no obvious third way for radical Christian politics to gain traction, I believe Christian faithfulness requires us to discern the signs of the times instead of waxing nostalgic for the good old days when everybody was equally against us. So in our remaining time, I want to introduce witnesses to the gospel of peace that may have gone overshadowed at EP by Yoder's influence, but who may provide us resources for discerning what nonviolent Christian faithfulness might look like for us today. In our book, we organize these under eight different headers, which represent eight different approaches to Christian nonviolence. I trust many of us are familiar with Reinhold Niebuhr's distinction between two forms of pacifism that he witnessed in his day. The first was a more inward-focused, quietist, absolutist, communalist pacifism that focuses on fidelity to Jesus' teachings on non-resistance, and in so doing offers a witness to the world of another kingdom without trying to change the world. And the second was a more outward-focused, activist, political pacifism that takes Jesus' teachings maybe a tad less literally and focuses instead on the effectiveness of nonviolence, using nonviolence as a tool for social change and political transformation in the world. Niebuhr's distinction has persisted in the popular imagination as the first communal kind of nonviolence has come to be associated with names like Yoder and Hauerwas, and maybe by extension, the Ecclesia Project. And the second political kind of nonviolence has come to be associated with Martin Luther King Jr. and nonviolent movements for civil rights. Perhaps we might think of this distinction as whether one prefers to render the kaiosune as righteousness or justice in the Beatitudes, as in, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for dikaiosune, for they shall be filled. I structure my presentation on these eight streams with this distinction of the two in mind, the first four kind of in the more communal camp and the second four in the more political camp. And after presenting each of these two groups, we'll take some time, maybe 10 minutes, to split into groups, maybe around these tables if there's enough space there, to discuss these four questions. One, how does each stream of Christian nonviolence resonate with my own understanding of Christian nonviolence, or that of EP more generally? Two, what about each stream do I find challenging or even troubling? Three, what might it look like to practice each approach in my church context? And four, what might it look like for EP to embody this approach to nonviolence going forward? In doing so, I think we'll find that Niebuhr's distinction is a bit simplistic, as each stream has its own unique theologic. So first, nonviolence of Christian discipleship. This, as we've said, is most often associated with Yoder and his followers. But in my course, I've swapped out assigning Yoder's politics of Jesus with assigning Andre Trocmé's Jesus and the Nonviolent Revolution. And my mostly Mennonite students often identify this book as a highlight of the course. Many of us know the story of Andre and Magda Trakme and their small mountainous village of La Chambon, France, which became a refuge for nearly 5,000 Jews and other persons fleeing the Holocaust. In a biography of Trakme, pastor and leader of the movement, the biographer asks, how is it that the population of La Chambon and the surrounding area almost unanimously embraced the rescue effort? The answer lies in Trakme's understanding of nonviolence as a form of Christian discipleship. This stream emphasizes the role of the gathered Christian community in Christian nonviolence. Nonviolence is a way of living in the world, shaped by the reading of scripture, corporate worship, and the practices of life together. Christian nonviolence is a habit of regular discipleship, which then becomes the mode of engagement in times of crisis. Jesus in the Nonviolent Revolution offers a reading of the Gospels, particularly Luke's Gospel, to make the case for nonviolence as the way of the communities that Jesus founded. Trakme connects the churches of Jesus to the ethic of Jesus on precisely this point, that to be a disciple of Jesus is not simply to confess faith in Jesus, but also to follow Jesus in the way of the cross. For Trakme, it's not enough to say that Jesus' example is one of nonviolence. Instead, Jesus' very substance as the mediator between the community and God abolishes whatever violence was previously present. For Trakme, the way in which Jesus mediates for humanity and the way in which the church is connected to Christ morally and to the world in witness are intricately related. There is a sacramental matrix of divine imitation in which the church follows in the way of Jesus. And in this, it's in this way that Jesus joins us to God the Father. Secondly, nonviolence of Christian virtue. Dorothy Day, a Marxist convert to Catholicism, often wrote affectionately about her Marxist past. For the things she appreciated about Marxism were the very things she saw brought to fulfillment in Christianity. Marxists spoke of loving the poor, but Christians spoke of this and loving their oppressors. Marxists spoke of feeding the poor, while Christianity spoke of this and of feeding the soul. For Day, Marxism in many ways represented a glittering vision of temporal life, but Christianity offered that world crowned by the love of God. Throughout her life, Day thus affirmed that the natural virtues as she saw them exercised in unlikely places, from Ho Chi Minh to Gandhi. And throughout her life, she continued to work in coalitions with non-Catholics, seeing the virtuous non-Christian as on the way to the kingdom of God. No place is Day's approach clearer than with the practice of nonviolence. War forms us, she said, in all the wrong kinds of virtues. War produces new divisions within humanity and justifies practices that reinforce those divisions. Taxation, nationalistic rhetoric, racism, and so forth. Not only does nonviolence bear witness to a different way of viewing the world, but practicing it forms us towards God's kingdom by forming in us a different set of virtues. Whereas acts of justice and courage can be seen in many places, nonviolence transfigures these acts by redirecting them toward Christ. Day describes a practice of nonviolence as among the works of mercy, through which people not only witness to Christ's work, but are also transformed as they do them. Since the late 1970s, Stanley Hauerwas has been at the forefront of the recovery of virtue among Protestant Christian ethics, albeit in a slightly idiosyncratic way. Rather than beginning by enumerating the virtues as Thomas Aquinas does, Hauerwas speaks of character as the all-encompassing form of human life. If we take our cues from the person of Jesus as to what a virtuous life looks like, Hauerwas contends, the picture of virtue is inseparable from being a person of nonviolence. Nonviolence is one of the practices we learn in the church becomes habitual over time, interwoven with how we understand the classical virtues. The narrative of what it means to be a Christian is judged according to whether it coheres to Jesus' own life. Auerwas's account of the virtues is thus interwoven with nonviolence. To be a person of Christian virtue is inextricably to be a nonviolent person. For Auerwas, virtue takes a specific narrative form embodied in the life of the church as the church learns to live out the narrative of Scripture in its own day and time. Hopefully those two were relatively familiar. Now we might move into a little bit less familiar territory for some of us. So Howard Thurman, pastor and dean of chapel at Howard University and Boston University, was a one-time Baptist minister deeply involved in struggles against segregation and racism. He was part of a delegation who traveled in 1935 to visit Gandhi, bringing back Gandhi's vision of nonviolence to America. But unlike some who would later emphasize the tactical nature of Gandhi's vision, such as Gene Sharp, Thurman resonated with the mystical center of Gandhi's thought, viewing it as the center of any cohesive account of nonviolence. For Thurman, nonviolence is rooted in a transformative encounter of the soul with God. It's only in such an encounter with God that the soul opens up a new way of living in the world. For nonviolent mystics, the mystical basis of nonviolence addresses the deepest sources of our conflict, our distorted vision of ourselves and of God. Yet this basis is difficult to articulate, for as German theologian and mystic Dorothy Swehle writes, mysticism is an experience of God, an experience of being one with God that breaks through the existing limitations of human comprehension, feeling, and reflection. For the mystics, our union is in the God who's beyond language, beyond being captured as an idol. Although slipping beyond human comprehension makes the encounter with God difficult to speak of, it's also why mysticism leads to peace. For Thurman, in the mystical encounter of prayer, one transcends the particularities that divide Christians and centers one's attention and being on God, the source of all existence. This experience before God for Thurman drives down to the core of the issue of violence, the self-righteous and egoistic self. In the encounter with God, who is love, the self-righteous ego is given no place to hide and is displaced from its throne by the desire for the unity and beauty of God. Thurman writes that our conflicts are self-perpetuating as the wounded conform to their wounding, repeating the wounds we receive from others in an endless desire for revenge. The mystical encounter with God, by contrast, replaces our self-righteous need for vindication with a desire for union because the soul has witnessed the love of God. Well, on May 17th, 1968, nine Catholic activists opened up a new avenue for nonviolence. Going to the Selective Service Office in Cantonsville, Maryland, these activists took several hundred draft cards and set them ablaze in the parking lot using homemade napalm. In destroying implements of war, they began to confront the means of war more actively. In subsequent years, figures like William Stringfellow and Daniel Berrigan articulated this apocalyptic vision for nonviolence as less concerned with being included in a robust democratic process and more committed to how nonviolence expresses the rot within the system it opposes. Apocalyptic nonviolence takes as its starting point not only that the cross and resurrection of Jesus unveiled the principalities and powers of the world for what they are, but also that Jesus' death and resurrection call Christians to actively oppose the machinations of death in the world. What is primary to apocalyptic nonviolence is the guiding conviction that nonviolence continues the work of God in Christ, which exposes death for what it is. The death and resurrection of Christ do not merely inspire us to act, but are carried forward by the power of the Spirit in the bodies and actions of Christians today. As such, the contest between death, with a capital D, and Christ continues through the actions of Christians who join in the revolution against the principalities and powers. According to Stringfellow, the various idols throughout society that lead us away from God are all motivated by a single power, death. In struggling against death, We are engaging not simply material structures, but also the demonic spirits animating their actions. For Stringfellow, the powers move people toward death in manifold ways, such that opposing them requires great discernment. Freedom, then, comes from the refusal to trust in any deliverance from death other than God and Christ. Stringfellow thus maintains a nefarious vision for the role of government. Writing in the wake of the arrest of the Berrigan brothers, who had been among the Cantonsville Nine, Stringfellow writes that the state has only one power it can use against human beings, death. The state can persecute you, prosecute you, imprison you, exile you, execute you. All of these things mean the same. The Plowshares movement, started by Philip Berrigan, was involved in numerous actions similar to the Cantonsville Nine. The group utilized tactics such as burglarizing an FBI office, hammering on warplanes and nuclear warheads, burning draft cards, and refusing to pay taxes to support the Vietnam War. None of these actions were designed necessarily to influence lawmakers, although opposing unjust laws drew attention to their injustice. But rather, these dramatic actions were meant to enact the ways of God over against death by beating a weapon into some other implement and by destroying those things that were assaulting human life. Incidentally, Sojourners interviewed Miles and me about the book and were really like into this view. I don't know why Sojourners would like this so much, but you can imagine. But a couple of months later, they did a review of the new movie, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, and they referenced our interview. So now I'm on record as supporting blowing up a pipeline. I don't know what my congregants think of that, but I don't know what I think of that either. But that comes from Apocalyptic Nonviolence. Well, at this point, we'll break into groups to evaluate these four streams of nonviolence by asking the four questions I mentioned before. I think for the sake of time, we'll take about 10 minutes to do this, so you don't have to systematically work through each of the four types and the four questions, but just what stuck out to you from these first four, and you can do popcorn style in groups. If you want to sit around a table, if that's more comfortable, you're welcome to move to the table, and then I'll call you back in like 10 minutes. There we go. I'd love to hear from all your groups. We'll have to do that during our break. So let's move on to realist nonviolence. In the aftermath of the Great War, World War I, Reinhold Niebuhr emerged as a critic of the social gospel peace movement of which he had earlier been a part. He argued that the pacifism of the social gospel was predicated on naive optimism about the possibilities of human societies that was thoroughly discredited by the war. According to Christian realism, Christ provides the absolute moral ideal, but humans, especially in societies, are incapable of achieving that ideal because of sin. When taking account of sinfulness, moral absolutes become elusive and compromises become necessary. For Niebuhr, such compromises include the willingness to use violent force to combat the greater evils of tyranny and anarchy. Niebuhr's Christian realism is often seen as marking a radical break from the social gospel movement that preceded it. But Niebuhr identifies leading theologian of the social gospel, Walter Rauschenbusch, as the voice of realism at the turn of the century. Rauschenbusch himself describes the social gospel as realistic in its interests, focusing on the concrete ethical aspects of Jesus' life and ministry. He argues that Jesus presented a number of axiomatic social convictions about the value of life, human solidarity, and standing up for the marginalized. On the question of violence, Rauschenbusch identifies Jesus as committed to absolute non-resistance, which he argues is not a strange and erratic part of Jesus' teaching. Nevertheless, Rauschenbusch does not suggests that society should determine policy by asking what would Jesus do, as one of his social gospel contemporaries proposed. Instead, he argues that the dominant purpose of Jesus' life was the establishment of the kingdom of God. And Rauschenbusch has thought the kingdom of God serves as an eschatological ideal that is never fully realizable within history, but that serves as a perpetual standard toward which to strive and by which to critique current social systems. At best, there is always but an approximation of the perfect social order, he writes. Rauschenbusch's own increasingly strident pacifism in his later years was based not on optimism about human society's ability to emulate Jesus, but rather on a realistic assessment of the moral and political destructiveness of war. He was virtually cast out from his social gospel peers for speaking out against the Great War, viewed as a German sympathizer, but he died shortly before the war ended, never got to see his vision realized. Well, in the aftermath of the Great War, a young Methodist philosopher named Georgia Harkness joined a young Niebuhr and others on a trip to Europe led by social gospel evangelist Sherwood Eddy. With their firsthand encounters with survivors of the war and their observations of the war's destructiveness, they were both disabused of any lingering naive optimism they may have shared, but they each drew differing lessons. Niebuhr came to reject pacifism as unrealistic, while Harkness came to adopt it as the only realistic way to pursue peace and justice in a fallen world. Harkness eventually moved from teaching philosophy to teaching theology, becoming the first woman to teach theology at an American seminary and the first woman to be elected member of the American Theological Society. There's a chair named after her at Northwestern. And she admits that wrestling with the thought of theologians like Niebuhr caused her earlier liberalism to become chastened and deepened. But despite these changes, her pacifism remained consistent. She writes, "I become more convinced pacifism in a day when many better Christians than I have felt compelled to surrender their pacifism. War destroys every value for which Christianity stands, and to oppose war by more war is only to deepen the morass into which humanity has fallen." On the question of compromise, however, Harkness agrees partially with Niebuhr. She writes, "The absolute demands of love must be lived out within the relativities of human existence, in which duties come mixed, and a perfect course of action is seldom upon us." Harkness thus believes that coercive force may be necessary within limits to maintain an approximation of justice. Shortly after the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, Baptist theologian Glenn Stassen began to articulate a form of realist nonviolence that he named just peacemaking, which was a middle way between pacifism and just war. He acknowledges that his thought is rooted in the realism of his own Union Theological Seminary teacher, Reinhold Niebuhr. In particular, he credits Niebuhr for teaching him to pay attention less to the hopeful ideals people declare than to their basic interests, and less to the promises of their high-sounding words than to the patterns of their actions. Instead of viewing war as a problem to be addressed when it erupts, just peacemaking emphasizes a series of peacemaking initiatives. One of the practical advantages of just peacemaking for Stassen is that one need not be a card-carrying pacifist in order to engage in peacemaking initiatives. This provides ecumenical possibilities for just peacemaking, as theological debates between just war traditions and pacifists are sidelined in favor of practical alliances. Well, sitting in a Birmingham jail in 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote a letter to his fellow clergy answering their question as to why an outside agitator was leading the African-American community of Birmingham in nonviolent protest. Acknowledging their complaint, he writes, "You deplore the demonstrations taking place in Birmingham, but your statement, I'm sorry to say, fails to express a similar concern for the conditions that brought about the demonstrations. It is unfortunate that demonstrations are taking place in Birmingham, but it's even more unfortunate that the city's white power structure left the Negro community with no alternative. In this letter, King signals the emergence of a different way of thinking about Christian nonviolence as a form of public political action. This stream is primarily concerned with how nonviolence as a normative Christian practice can be the basis for public action. It's for this reason that King emphasized the role of nonviolence as pricking the American conscience. King describes mass civil disobedience as a strategy for social change, which is at least as forceful as an ambulance with its siren on full. King's tactics serve the ends of publicizing immoral actions and putting pressure on white consciences with respect to racial injustices. In exercising protest in a nonviolent fashion, the civil rights movement provided the opportunity for interracial and democratic coalitions to be built. The democratic orientation of the political nonviolence lends to its practitioners seeking common cause from a plural audience. And so in the career of King, we see multiple kinds of public performances. At the onset of his career, explicitly theological actions accompanied his performance of nonviolence. Other actions led by King, however, are more broadly performed. Think his I Have a Dream speech. In these cases, King mobilizes the language of the church, though the performance is less explicitly religious in nature. The approaches of Cesar Chavez and Desmond Tutu likewise bear out this non-sectarian vision of Christian nonviolence. Chavez, a leader of the United Farm Workers strikes, intentionally used a mix of Catholic, Mexican, and Democratic imagery in his strikes and protests. This broad appeal was designed to connect to a Mesoamerican ethic of suffering that transcended religious confessionalism. Tutu likewise sees the work of Jesus as non-sectarian. Commenting on the disunity in South Africa, he writes, We have heard of God's dream from his prophets throughout history and modern times, from great leaders and humanitarians like Martin Luther King Jr. and Mahatma Gandhi. The vision and triumphs of these prophets of God help change their nations and inspire the rest of us around the world in our own struggles for equality. For Tutu, as with King, it is a moral universe that we inhabit, and good and right and equity matter in the universe of the God we worship. Trusting in the moral arc of the universe to bend in God's providence toward a justly ordered world, practitioners of Christian political nonviolence emphasize that means and ends must cohere. We cannot bear witness to an order characterized by nonviolence by using violent means. Oscar Romero confronted a multifaceted reality of violence when he became Archbishop of San Salvador in 1977. He didn't set out to be a liberation theologian, and there's lots of debates about whether he was. He distanced himself from the more radical wing of the movement and adhered closely to the church's social teachings. Yet it was precisely because of his adherence to the tradition of Catholic social teaching that he became an outspoken voice for the oppressed of El Salvador after he was appointed archbishop. Romero saw violence not as an interruption to the ordinary, but as an ordinary facet of the daily lives of Salvadorans. As agricultural land was privatized and concentrated in the hands of wealthy elites, the average Salvadorans lost their means of subsistence. For Romero, this situation is not merely an injustice that leads to violence, it is itself a form of violence. By depriving citizens of land to farm for themselves and their families, the landowners and the state apparatuses that supported them were inflicting violence on their fellow Salvadorans. To see and name violence rightly for Romero means identifying the roots and not merely the shoots of violence. It means seeing violence as a pervasive smog or tranquil water and not merely as bullets and bloodshed, though the former often leads to the latter. This ordinary violence, as Matthew Whalen calls it, is an assault against human dignity through deprivation of the necessities of life, which is then reified in structures and institutions. For publicly identifying and naming the structural violence of his society, Romero ultimately became its victim. On March 24, 1980, while celebrating the Mass at a hospital for the terminally ill, Romero was shot in the heart in an assassination ordered by a right-wing politician described as a principal henchman of wealthy landowners. If violence is as pervasive as liberationists describe, then a personal commitment to pacifism will not be sufficient to overcome it. Liberationist nonviolence, then, is not merely about refraining from overt acts of violence. It's about actively working to undo the violence that is inimical to human flourishing. To quote our preacher from last night, it's not about peacekeeping, it's about peacemaking. We find this emphasis on undoing violence in the work of Dom Helder Camara, Archbishop of Olinda and Recife, Brazil, from 1964 to 1985. As with Romero, Camara used his platform to advocate for the poor of his country, even as he was subjected to censorship and threat from Brazil's military dictatorship and power throughout the duration of his term. Camara was an outspoken advocate of liberation theology who took a decidedly nonviolent approach. In his 1971 tract, Spiral of Nonviolence, which you can download for free online, Camara writes, "It's common knowledge that poverty kills just as surely as the most bloody war. But poverty does more than kill. It leads to physical deformity, to psychological deformity, and to moral deformity." As with Romero, Camara identifies such violence by its pervasiveness, its ordinariness. "You will find that everywhere the injustices are a form of violence," he writes. "One can and must say that they are everywhere the basic violence." The natural response to such violence is violent revolt. And although Camara writes as a committed pacifist, he doesn't condemn violent revolt in principle. Instead, he argues strategically and pragmatically that revolutionary violence is ineffective as a response to institutionalized violence. It simply makes the authorities consider themselves obliged to preserve and reestablish public order, even if this means using force. Camara isn't naive about the conscience of dictators. He painstakingly details all the ways authoritarian regimes try to stifle even nonviolent protest. But he argues that nonviolent action is the most effective way to engender the sympathies of the people, especially young people, and that change cannot happen without widespread public support. Those in power will always act in their self-interest, so applying liberating moral pressure to fight injustice is a way to make them see that it is in their self-interest to do what's just. The goal of liberationist nonviolence is not merely to minimize the clash between revolutionary force and state force. Rather, it's about addressing the root causes of such violence, the institutionalized and structural violence. Kumar writes, "Generally speaking, the strategy of nonviolent action aims to cause the foundations of unjust power to collapse. Oppressive, repressive power rests on resignation, collaboration, and obedience on the part of the people. Nonviolence tries to organize non-collaboration and disobedience by as many people as possible. No power can last long, even by force of arms, against a whole population that refuses to obey it and recognizes another power instead." Okay, our last forum, and then we'll have 10 minutes. We'll cut into our break a little bit, I think, with permission from somebody who grants that permission. So in March 2019, 15 women, including EP's Erin Dufault Hunter, convened for a writing consultation at AMBS on the theme Liberating the Politics of Jesus. The combination of this location and this theme was not coincidental. These women were meeting in the very building where John Howard Yoder had taught and written for nearly three decades, until a disciplinary process in 1992 led to his dismissal from campus for sexualized violence. The question of how one of the leading 20th century advocates of Christian nonviolence could have engaged in violent conduct toward women has vexed many proponents of Christian nonviolence. But to the women gathering at this consultation, the problem with peace theology has always been its failure to see the integral connections between the violence of war and genocide and the violence of sexualized and gender-based violence. This observation leads to our final stream, Christian anti-violence. This is active resistance to sexualized and gender-based forms of violence, whether interpersonal or societal. Christian anti-violence begins not with abstract theological or ethical principles or even with interpretations of scripture. Rather, it begins with reflection on the experiences of women and sexual minorities, especially victims, survivors of sexualized violence. And it draws from those experiences to interrogate theological and ethical categories and biblical interpretations, and to dismantle the patriarchal and white supremacist systems and structures that perpetuate sexualized and gender-based violence. Experience, which is the basis for all knowledge, has become the primary source of comprehending sexual violence. So writes pastor, theologian, and victim survivor advocate Marie Fortune on the opening page of her pioneering 1983 work, Sexual Violence, The Unmentionable Sin. According to Fortune, sexual violence as a topic for ethical discourse among Christians has gone unaddressed. As the founding director of the Faith Trust Institute in Seattle, Fortune writes not only out of her own experiences, but also out of the stories of sexualized violence shared by victim survivors with which she worked. Following Fortune, one of the defining features of Christian anti-violence is that it begins with and centers on the experiences of victim survivors. And the criterion to assess whether forms of Christian nonviolence, the criterion by which to assess forms of Christian nonviolence is this: do they contribute to or combat sexualized and gender-based violence? In her 1999 book, Wounds of the Spirit, Tracy West centers the experiences of Black women in her development of an ethic of resistance to interpersonal violence. She writes, "It's by personally listening to women that I have come to recognize the specific interwoven nature of the intimate and systemic violence African-American women face." West's work moves through stages of carefully listening to women's stories and hearing their anguish before assessing the causes of their suffering and developing concrete methods of resistance within the church and otherwise. Doing so ensures that her proposals for resisting and overcoming violence against women are not simply theoretical, but include tangible ethical practices of communal resistance. Maybe for next year, we could do a study of her last chapter of her book where she lays out specific practices in the church to resist sexual violence. Fortune describes sexualized violence as first and foremost an act of violence, hatred, and aggression. It's like other acts of violence in that there's a violation of and injury to victims, whether those injuries be physical or psychological or both. For Fortune, sexualized violence is primarily about violence and only secondarily about the sexual nature of that violence. What makes it violence is not that it's sexual, but that it's a profound violation of another person, which is injurious and destructive. At the same time, she says that sexualized violence is in many ways especially violent. Any victim knows that she's experienced the most violent act possible, short of murder, she writes. West calls Christian communities to come alongside women who initiate resistance on behalf of themselves, and in so doing, advance the interests of a civil society, enlisting Christian ethics in this project of constructing what she calls an ethic of violence resistance. Such a Christian social ethic begins with an unflinching commitment to taking violence against African-American women seriously. Doing so exposes the ways white supremacy, patriarchy, and sexualized and gender-based violence are intimately connected. An ethic of violence resistance, therefore, must involve not only empowering women to resist abusive partners, but also committing the church to dismantle white supremacy and patriarchy within it and surrounding society. We might say that's her vision for letting the church be the church. Well, let's break up once again into our groups and take about 10 minutes to evaluate these last four approaches, and then I'll have some very brief closing words. Check. You can hear me clap once. You can hear me clap twice. When I say Father, you say Son. Father, Father. When I say Holy, you say Spirit. Holy, Holy. It's supposed to be Ghost, but yeah. Yeah, there we go. Clearly, I'm not theologian / hip-hop artist, but all right. Well, as I hope we've seen, Christian nonviolence is not a settled position, whether we call it Yodarian or not, but it's a form of spirit-led discernment about that which is good and acceptable and perfect. It's the work we're doing right now around tables. The eight streams we've discussed reach the conclusions they do because of different underlying theologics that animate them. For Christian nonviolence to live into the future, it not only must address itself to the old ways of violence, but must also include a vision for addressing the proliferation of new forms of violence. As we move further into the 21st century, we can continue to learn from the great cloud of witnesses to Christian nonviolence in its many forms from the 20th and 21st centuries as we've surveyed. What's ultimately needed to face new challenges will not be a single unified form of Christian nonviolence, but a proliferation of new and creative forms, each drawing wisdom from the past while looking ahead to ever-evolving challenges. This will mean the willingness of proponents of each stream, including ecclesial nonviolence, to acknowledge that those of the other streams are likewise anticipating the peace of God in their practice and witness, and to creatively and patiently live in witness to the Prince of Peace, who heals the world of all the forms of violence in it. So I want to close by thanking EP for its vital role in the work it's done in the decades since 9/11, and to invite you to continue that work in new ways as together we face the challenges that lie ahead. May the peace of Christ be with you as you do.